Thank you so much for having me. It's really nice to be with you. It's nice to see some old faces, and look forward to catching up with you a bit more later, and look forward to meeting lots of new people as well. Sorry if this is an illustration that you've heard before. It's not original to me, but I think a helpful way of setting up a weekend like this. I want you to imagine that you've just woken up. You can't remember anything beyond about 10 seconds ago when I started speaking. You can't remember your name, where you're from, what you had for breakfast this morning. For the sake of argument, the only thing that you can remember is how to speak English, and everybody else in the room is in the same position. And imagine that the windows are all blocked up and we can't see out. The door is shut and locked. There's no literature in the room. Believe it or not, there are no phones in the room. Pretty soon the cogs are going to start whirring, aren't they? Who am I? Why am I here? What's life all about in this room? Is there anything beyond this room? How should I live in this room? All sorts of questions. And all we'd have to go on is guesswork. So sure, the scientists among us would start to, I guess, do lots of experiments around the properties of things in the room, the chairs and the tables. And they might work out some very useful things for us. But when it comes to questions of meaning and purpose, the big why questions, well, they would say, well, we can't know. In fact, they might go further than that and say, actually, there is nothing beyond this room. This room is all that there was, all that there is, all that there will ever be. But then, of course, the more philosophically minded amongst us would say, well, I can't believe that. I can't believe that I'm just a bag of chemicals. I can't believe that all the emotions I feel are just reactions in my nerve cells or whatever it happens to be. And so those amongst us would start to dream up our own versions of reality. And we'd all come up with our different ideas on those big questions. And there would be lots of speculation and lots of guessing and lots of hypothesizing. But ultimately, we'd all be guessing. Because within the room, no one can know. But then I want you to imagine that we hear the sound of the key in the door, and the door opens, and somebody walks in and they say, let me tell you about life beyond the room. Let me tell you about Maidenhead, about cars and streets and trees and parks and people. Here is a unique word from outside. And I think we would have to say that what that person had to say belongs in a completely different category. And that is what the Bible calls the doctrine of revelation. That's what the Bible calls revelation. And that is what we're going to think about for a little bit over the course of the next few minutes over today. How does God speak? How do we get answers to all of those big questions? How does the Creator communicate with the creature? And can I say, I think nothing more important, nothing more foundational, nothing more significant for us to be spending a few minutes thinking about over the course of today. You're going to need a Bible and a pen, and we're on the handout there. And because I'm a fundamentally lazy person, I'm going to get you doing a little bit of the work during some of these sessions. And I'll get you turning into twos and threes to have a bit of discussion and chat. And as I mentioned a few moments ago, what I want to do really, the start of today, point one on the handout there, what I want to do is talk about something called the creator-creature distinction. And rather than immediately firing off and talking about the doctrine of Scripture or the Holy Spirit or all those sorts of things, I want to self-consciously take a step back and put this doctrine of revelation in its broadest possible context. And we're going to go all the way back So thinking about who God is, who's the creator, who's the one speaking, and who are we as creatures? How competent are we at finding out truth for ourselves? And we're going to build things up from there, from those first principles and right back there. So over to you. I'd love you to turn up Isaiah 40, maybe read that quietly or as a group, and just have a think at those questions on the sheet. What is God like? And who is he? So over to you. I'll give you 5-10 minutes. Isaiah 40. It's a cool chapter of the Bible. Isaiah 40, what is God like? It's a trick question, isn't it? Because he is not like anything. Verse 25. To whom will you compare me? Verse 25. I am not like anything else. I don't know if you can relate to this, but I think when I think about God, I instinctively think of someone who is like me, but bigger and better. So a maxi human. Take Chris Fishlock, put a bicycle pump in his mouth, inflate him a few times, and basically you've got God, haven't you? He is a zooped up version of me. He is just a pumped up version of us. But if you have a look at Isaiah 40, he blows that kind of thinking out of the water. Verse 12. Verse 12, Isaiah 40. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? I mean, I did an experiment once. I think I got about 5 milliliters in the hollow of my hand. You know, how long would that take me to empty my bath? How many baths in a swimming pool? How many swimming pools in a lake? How many lakes in the English Channel? How many English Channels in the Pacific Ocean? Can you see what we're saying? God is not like you. You need to start thinking about God a bit differently. Or end of verse 12 there. Who has weighed the mountains in the scales, the hills in a balance? You know, think of my kitchen scales. Error message when I stand on them. God's Mount Everest, like a speck of dust. As we begin to think about this doctrine of Revelation, who is the one speaking? The sense of scale needs to change. We need to start thinking about God differently. Your God is too small. Christian down here was mentioning verse 16. I love verse 16. Has anyone ever seen a cedar of Lebanon? We've got a country house near us called Forty Hall, and about 200 years ago, this famous botanist, I think, planted a cedar of Lebanon, and it's now this gigantic tree. Well, verse 16, the cedars of Lebanon, they are the finest bits of tree you can get your hands on in the Bible. But even if we were to take all the forests of Lebanon and make the biggest fire that you can, it would still not be enough to make an adequate sacrifice. The world does not have enough resources to praise God, to offer him his due. Our sense of scale needs to change. Or over the column there, verse 23, God sovereign over the affairs of humanity. Can you see that? He raises up princes, he brings them down again. Think of the most famous, well, powerful person perhaps he's ever lived. Maybe think of a Joseph Stalin. Untouchable, unmeasured power. No one would dare take him on. But then verse 24, the person you're thinking about, like dust, like grass, we are here for a moment. God remains. So what is God like? What is God like? Well, he's like nothing. We often think that the fundamental distinction in the universe is between good and evil, or between natural and supernatural. But actually, the Bible wants to say the biggest distinction in the universe is between the creator and the creature, everything that he has made. You could put everything in the universe in those two categories. Everything has made by God, stamped on the bottom of it, except for the creator himself. By contrast, you and I, we are radically limited here in this room. Limited by time. We have a beginning. I was born on the 17th of March, 1979, for your notes. History happened before me. It will probably happen, I guess, after me. limited by power. When was the last time that you managed to stay awake for 24 hours without falling asleep? When was the last time you got through the winter without getting a cold? Despite all the moisturizer I use, I still do not look like Tom Cruise. We are not as in control of our lives as we'd like to think. And verse 26, the creation, can you see there, not independent of its creator. You do not have an existence apart from God. Your life would disappear like a dream if he did not continue to uphold you second by second. And can you see there, verse 26, the same is true of all the starry host and the whole universe. Limited by knowledge, what I know. I know some stuff about business and finance. It's what I used to do for a living. I know some stuff about Scottish mountains because it's what I love to do on my holidays, go hiking up in Scotland. But ask me about all sorts of things, I am very, very quickly out of my depth. I don't even know everything there is in the room, let alone some of the bigger questions about what might lie beyond the room. Limited by geography. When I'm hiking the hills in Scotland, I can't see what's happening at the Arsenal. I do not know. Even with the advent of the internet, I don't know everything that's happening in the world. Hard to remember sometimes, isn't it? Exactly what you did this morning. We are limited creatures. Yeah, granted, we are pretty special and we have done some amazing things. But in the cold light of day, when you think about this creator-creature distinction, are we really capable on our own of figuring out life? How competent are we at finding out truth within the room? Are we really up to answering those big questions of life? Or could it be actually, without revelation, we're just guessing? We're just fumbling around in the dark. But actually, as we put this doctrine of revelation in its broadest possible theme, I think it actually the problem is even worse than that, because it's not just that as a creature I have limited access to truth, it's also that as a creature I have a preference for untruth. Okay, it's not just that I'm small and finite, I'm also fallen and blind. Do you want to come with me now to Romans chapter 1? Let's go to Romans 1.
Right, Romans 1, 18 to 21. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and by nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened.
Thank you. So he's talking about the doctrine of revelation. How we know God. And he says within the room there are certain things that we can know. Did you notice that? It's what theologians call natural revelation. That actually creation, God's eternal power, his divine nature, reveals some things to us about God. In some ways we need to slightly modify that opening illustration in the room. But clearly Paul is not saying we can know everything from creation. So you can't go skiing for a day and work out that God is Trinity. Or you can't, you know, go to Ibiza or something and work out what God is like, what his character is like. Nevertheless, there are some things within the room that we can know about God. But have a look, what do we do, verse 18, with that knowledge that he gives us, that revelation that comes to us? What do we do? Do we treasure it? Do we marvel it? Do we put it on the mantelpiece and cherish it? Or verse 18, do we suppress it? Do we put it in a hole, build a patio over the top, sit back, drink a beer, and pretend that it's not there? What's more, I think Paul goes on to say that this is not some conscious decision. So it's not like, oh, I really weigh the evidence and I make a decision. But what he's saying, if you flick over the page and have a look now at verse 28, he's saying that actually we cannot do anything but reject the truth. We're hardwired to suppress the truth. Do you see there, verse 28? He says we have he calls it a debased mind, a depraved mind. Our minds are broken. We're like the person on the dance floor with the music, the bass booming at them, the lights pulsating, but I've got my fingers in my ears and my eyes are closed. I'm not looking. I'm not listening. And what this means is that when it comes to those big questions of life that we're thinking about, actually, we don't want answers. We don't want the truth. We prefer lies. If I'm asking, why am I here? I am naturally going to want an answer that paints God out of the picture. We'd rather stay in the dark than have the lights switched on. And even when the truth comes at us on a plate, I'm going to cast it aside. I'm like a corrupt judge who deliberately wants to misread the evidence because I have an interest in the answers turning out a certain way. My way. And so just if I can, for a few minutes, speak in square brackets, and I'm really sorry to use labels. I hate to use labels, but they are just sometimes a helpful shorthand. But just by the by, this is why the whole project of liberal theology is so flawed. And by liberal theology, what I mean in this area of the doctrine of revelation, a theology that casts aside God's revelation for my thoughts and my opinions and my wisdom. And it's an area of theology that is flawed because it underestimates this gap between the creator and the creature. And it fails to take seriously Romans 1, that I am not an impartial observer here. So if you think about it, that is why in liberal theology, when the Bible is set aside, God always becomes that projection, and he always ends up being a projection of reigning cultural values. So as someone once put it, I think very helpfully, they said the liberal theologian looks down the well of history to find the historical Jesus, and all they find is their own face reflected back at them from the bottom. And God becomes the zooped up version of me. His desires and preferences very, very conveniently fit with my desires and preferences. So have you guys ever seen the film or read the book, The Stepford Wives? Have you seen The Stepford Wives? And it's about a neighbourhood called Stepford. And starts off, you know, all looking wonderful, marital harmony. But as the book goes on, it becomes more and more disturbing. And you realise that these frighteningly submissive women are actually robots. And they've just been programmed by their husbands to do exactly what their husbands want them to do. And I think the question we have to ask here is do you want a Stepford God? Do you want a God who basically just agrees with everything that you think and say? And of course, classically, I mean, every culture is different at different points. Classically, in our culture at the moment, I guess it is the questions of sexuality and gender, where very conveniently, what I think about those things are what God thinks about those things. A passage I've been teaching recently, back at St. Thomas's, 2 Samuel 6, there's no need to flick there, but it's 2 Samuel 6, there's an incident in that passage that we find really offensive as human beings, and we struggle with it. The Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament, it represents the presence of God. It's coming back into the land of Israel, and it's being pulled on a cart by some oxen, and the oxen stumble, and the Ark of the Covenant's about to fall on the floor, and a man called Uzzah puts his hand out and stops the Ark falling on the ground. And because he does that, the anger of the Lord is kindled and he's struck down. And you and I, we read that and we think, come on, God, give him a break. Why so severe? Why couldn't you cut him some slack? It's a story that seems to cut against the grain of human preference. And if we were to return back to that illustration at the start, put your hands up if within the room you're going to come up with the God of 2 Samuel 6. And that is one of the reasons, I think, why the Bible is true and why it's from God and not a human invention. Because if I can put it this way, the God of 2 Samuel 6, he's not very marketable. No one would invent him. No one would come up with this God. And that is, I think, part of a bigger picture of the supernatural origin of the Bible and the reasons for that. Tim Keller, he's a pastor in New York, puts it brilliantly. He says, the Bible is reassuringly unfashionable. I really like that, reassuringly unfashionable. So do you see the point? Not a projection of your wish fulfillment. Not a zooped up version of me. Not a projection of reigning cultural values. The God of the Bible, he places demands on me. He challenges me. He says things that I disagree with. He says things that I find hard. And it's only if you have a God who says things that you struggle with that you can know that you're worshipping a real God and not a figment of your imagination. And so this whole project of liberal theology, where I set aside God's word and say, well, it's what I think, what I reckon, my wisdom, my thoughts. Well, it's doomed to failure because it just doesn't take seriously enough this gap between creator and creature. And it fails to take Romans 1 seriously. We cannot talk competently about God without him revealing himself to us. And so in summary, point one, we've got a big problem, haven't we, here? I am too limited to come up with the answers. I'm incapable of knowing everything within the room, let alone what lies beyond it. On top of that, even if I did have the truth, I'd suppress it. Because I'm blind. And I'm fallen. We are going to need God to reveal himself in a way that both overcomes our finitude and our fallenness. We're going to need God to step into the room, open the door, and to turn the lights on. Okay, God is there, I am here. And what that diagram, bottom of page one there, is trying to say is that the gap between us and God is bigger than you realised. The gulf is massive. Brilliant. But that takes us to point two, over the page there. Jesus is God introducing himself. And now would be a really good moment to turn to John's Gospel. So if we go to John's Gospel now.
In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men.
Brilliant. So hopefully that phrase in the beginning, hopefully that rings some big Bible bells. Very first words of the Bible, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. And now John adds to that by saying in the beginning was the Word and the Word was with God. And that makes sense, doesn't it? If you think about the creation account. So how does God create? How does he make the stars? How does he make the animals bring forth human beings? And of course he creates by speaking through his words. And now John says, let me introduce you to the words. And so it is as if we could draw a timeline, I guess, across the room. Over here we could go back to the beginning of everything, over here to the end of everything. And what John is saying is there is never a point when Jesus doesn't exist. There is never a point when the Son is not. So it's not this year we are celebrating Jesus' 2022nd birthday. You know, how many candles do you put on Jesus' cake? No, he is eternal. He sounds quite a lot, doesn't he? Like the God of Isaiah 40. John goes on, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the key to understanding what is going on here, I think, is to realise there are two people in the verse. There is God and there is the Word, the one who was with God. The thing that catches you out, though, I think, is that John refers to them both as God. And he sees no contradiction in that. He calls Jesus God, while at the same time saying that Jesus was with God. And that is why verse 3, he is the creator. Through him, all things were made. Without him, nothing has been made that was made. So do you remember we said earlier you could divide everything into two categories in the universe? There is the creator and there is the creation, and everything in the universe, one of those two categories. The question now comes, well, which side of the division does Jesus go on? Where do you put him? And John says, he is the creator God who made everything. First time I ever spoke at these verses was at a Christmas craft fair. Can you imagine speaking on these verses at a Christmas craft fair? And verse 3, it's quite a thing to say, isn't it, at a Christmas craft fair? What are you making this evening at the craft fair? Well, Jesus, he made everything. Lo, within a manger lies he who built the starry skies. Can you see? It sounds quite a lot like the God of Isaiah 40 as we begin to think about the diagram on the bottom of the screen. And if that's not enough, verse 4, I love this. John just keeps layering it on, doesn't it? It's like a Christmas tree, decoration after decoration after decoration. Verse 4, in him was life, and the life was the light of humankind. All of us are dependent in some way. We saw that in Isaiah 40. I need food and I need sleep, and if I don't get those things, I initially become grumpy and then I become unconscious. And that is part of what it means to be a human being. But verse 4, Jesus, he's not like you. In him was life. Self-existing, uncreated, life in himself. It sounds quite a lot, doesn't it? Like the God of Isaiah 40. Can you see why this baby divides history in two? Can you see why the first biographies of his life are still international bestsellers? You didn't think, did you, that he was just a good person? And what this means, doctrine of revelation, can you see that Jesus is fully qualified to make God known? He is on the right side of the distinction, isn't he? He is not limited by time, by geography, by wisdom, by knowledge. He is fully qualified. But of course, that means absolutely nothing if he just stays around in heaven with the Father. If he just does that, well, then we are still in the dark and we're still guessing within the room. But of course, John 1 doesn't end there. And have a look at that verse that we started our meeting with, verse 14. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. So have a look at this. These are the shanty towns, the favelas in Rio de Janeiro. I think 1 million people living in these slums in Rio. Poverty, grinding disease, unemployment. But then up high, exalted over the city, up in the clouds, the statue of Jesus towering over the city, the Christ of the Corcovado. The story is told of a poor man from the favelas climbing up to the statue of Jesus towering over the city. And the poor man speaks to Jesus like this. He says, I have climbed up to you, Christ, from the filthy confined quarters down there to put before you most respectfully these considerations. There are 1 million of us down there in those slums of that city. And you, Christ, do you remain up here at Corcovado, surrounded by divine glory? Well, have a look at verse 14 again. The claim is that the eternal Son has taken on flesh. And that is quite a claim, isn't it? In a culture that says that God is distant, unknowable, that really is quite a claim. And notice, I think this is so important, he doesn't just take on a body, but he takes on flesh. Flesh, it speaks of human weakness. Afterbirth, vomit, dirty nappies. Think of cut skin, grazed knees. The eternal Son of God, he takes on flesh. Flesh, blood, bone, sinew, gristle, meat. Chili con carne, chili with meat, that's what con carne means, the incarnation, the enfleshment of God. This is not where's the line from that carol? The cattle are lowing, the baby awakes, the little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. No, the baby screams his head off when he wakes up. He takes on flesh. He's a real human being. And that means doctrine of revelation, that Jesus is not only qualified to make God known, but he makes God known in a way that we can understand. He speaks our language, not simply by speaking the language of first century Judea, but by bridging that gap between us and God. And so had we lived 2,000 years ago, we could have met God. And lots of people did, and this is what they saw, his authority. Seasoned fishermen, speechless, as he calms a storm with a word. His humility, the humility that reaches out and touches the leper, the humility that washes his disciples' feet, his compassion that feeds the hungry, that defends the oppressed. He says, now is the moment to display the Father's glory. Here is the big moment of revelation. And then on a hot and dusty day, he dies for a rebellious world. And with his final breath, he says, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. When you look at Jesus, you see God's glory. God is there. We are here. There is a massive gulf between us. But Jesus is God introducing himself. I want to just finish this first session by reading out a little extract from something written by J.B. Phillips about a senior angel showing a junior angel around the universe. The young angel had been taken on a grand tour. He'd seen whirring galaxies and blazing suns and infinite distances. And finally, they come close to the planet that we call the sun and to its the star that we call the sun, sorry, and its little planets circling around it. And the senior angel points to a small and rather insignificant little sphere turning very slowly on its axis. It looks as dull as a dirty tennis ball to the junior angel, whose mind was filled with the glories of the things that he'd seen. I want you to watch that one in particular, said the big angel. Well, it looks very small and dirty to me, said the young angel. What's so special about that one? The senior angel told him the story, and the young angel listened in stunned disbelief. Do you mean to tell me that our great and glorious prince took on flesh and entered that dirty and insignificant little world? Yes, said the big angel. That planet, which I dare say looks small and insignificant to you, is the renowned visited planet. Strange as it might seem to us, our young prince entered their world, became one of those creatures, so that they could know him. The little angel went blank. Such a thought was beyond his comprehension. God is there, we are here, massive gulf. Doctrine of revelation. Jesus is God introducing himself. He unlocks the door, steps into the room. Let me give you the answers to all the big questions. Here's the problem though, folks. Here's the big problem. I've never met Jesus physically. And if he is the big, unique revelation event, if he is the supreme revelation of God, he says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. But I've missed the unique revelation events. Oh no. Does that mean I'm still guessing? Does that mean I'm still fumbling around in the dark? Well, we'll come back to that question. Let's finish there.